This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People who choose to live in tiny homes, they really want to take care of the nature for the future generations, and we can learn a lot from each other. So I think the future is tiny house communities.
Shelter is on the first rung of renowned psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And yet, as a society, we have not cracked the code for how to house people in a way that's equitable and sustainable. While millions consume cubic acres of carbon, heating and cooling their McMansions, others combat housing insecurity on a daily basis. This week on Sea Change Radio, we discuss two different facets of the housing puzzle. First, we take a look at the tiny homes movement with two builders, Fati and Dennis Saad. They describe what the target customer base is for their Lilliputian locales, their design inspiration, and how these itty-bitty domiciles could potentially transform communities of the future. Next, we hear from San Francisco Supervisor Rafael Mandelman to learn about his unique journey into politics and to talk about the issue of homelessness in America. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Fati Saad and Dennis Saad. They're the CEO and operations manager for Saad Homes, based in Manhattan. Fati, Dennis, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's very nice to be on your show.
Thanks, Alex.
So Saad Homes are known as tiny houses on wheels. Why don't you explain the concept and how it differs from trailer homes?
These are actually real homes in a smaller version, and trailer homes are made out of fiberglass, and people usually stay them in them a few weeks in the summer or a few months maybe maximum. But the tiny homes are built with the thickness of the walls, with the insulation, and inside and outside covered with pine in the And also, it's smaller than most of the mobile homes, that so you can tow them with your trucks, and you can park them anywhere, and then you live in them.
And what is your target demographic with these homes?
I'd say from a lot of the tiny home showrooms that we went to, there were a lot of, I'd say mostly lower middle class, double income, no kids, individuals, or people in their 30s to 50s.
Mostly urban.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
And can you give us an idea of the price range, not just for your homes, but when we're talking about tiny homes in general as a segment of the home industry, what kind of price range should a prospective buyer expect to pay?
They range from, if they are built by the owners, it could be around $20,000 and up. And if they're a professional build, it could be $30,000 up to $95,000 or even $100,000.
And the homes themselves can be moved. So what does somebody in Manhattan do with a tiny home? I mean, property is much more valuable than, let's say, a $50,000 tiny home. So if somebody owns property where they can move their home, you would think that they would have enough to build a more spacious home. Is this a choice that people want to downscale, or is there a financial advantage to the mobility as well?
There's a financial advantage to be a mobile. In Manhattan, actually, the land is very expensive. Unless you have a big home, with a yard, maybe you can park it there. But Manhattan kind of is the exception for this. Queens, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Staten Island are more prone to people to have those kind of homes. And our goal is maybe half an hour or 45 minutes away from the city, get some land, and then design them for tiny homeowners to come and park and live there year-round. So they have the public transportation if they want to. And then they work in the city, and then they go home to live in these. Manhattan is actually really a very expensive place. So I don't know if anybody is lucky enough to have some small lot here to put their tiny homes.
So are there any efforts that you're aware of with social justice and advocacy organizations that are trying to address the problem of homelessness, governments or nonprofits that are investing in tiny homes for the needy?
Yes, I understand in California, San Francisco area, there are tiny homes. They're smaller than what we're building. We're building 8 by 20 plus in size, and ours are 300 square feet. But for homelessness, there are smaller versions of them, and they're building them, and they're trying to get cities accept the idea of neighborhoods, maybe, I don't know, a little farther than the city or suburban communities. People that they don't have homes can live in there until they get back on their feet and find jobs or better themselves. And this concept is really growing in the U.S., and I think it'll be a futuristic thing, better than building buildings for homeless. It's a lot cheaper, and even people can help homeless people to build when they're building them by organizations or by the people that they're homeless. So there's more opportunity for homeless individuals to own or live in these than having city-built buildings or try to build buildings. I don't know. It's more costly. But tiny homes are a lot cheaper, and people can donate materials, or construction companies can donate building materials. And this will help. This will help a lot all around the country, especially near big cities. And all we have to do is just make this available. As you know, cities shouldn't see them as an eyesore, but they should help, they should open up to the idea that people need homes, and these are, even though they're small, and these people need them, and they can help each other, they can share things with each other, and then they can get in a better position in life. They can better themselves. Yes, we do need to push for this, and we do need to advocate this.
Strange to some, but it's plain to me. No, it won't be long till we're safe asleep. When at last we're home.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Fatih Saat. He's the CEO of Saat Homes, as well as his son Dennis Saat, who's the operation manager. So beyond the downscale element and people downsizing their consumption living in a smaller home, maybe you can highlight some of the renewable and sustainable elements of a tiny home, maybe not just yours, but how insulated they are, and efficient electricity in terms of solar wiring, etc.
Oh yes, they're very efficiently insulated. Mostly, I believe we're using them styrofoam, thick styrofoam, through 2-3 inches thick, to insulate it. And as you know, the size is so small, it's easier to warm it up in the winter and cool it off in the summer. And mostly those homes are built with composting toilet that means that there's a lot less sewage production it creates. And there are also showers that, I don't think it's in the U.S. yet, or it's not as popular, but in Scandinavia and in Australia, two companies invented these showers that recycle the water. There's a tank under your feet when you're standing in the shower room. It's between 2 or 2.5 gallon container. So when you take a shower, it takes the water and filters it at a drinkable degree, and then it gives back to you. It's already warmed up, and so you're saving so much energy to warm it up. Plus, you can take a 10-hour shower with that 2.5 gallon water. So, and you're not producing any sewage. I think this should be applied to every building in the U.S., in the new buildings, and then old buildings should convert to that too. So we like in New York, our sewage overflows to Hudson River, which is the most beautiful river, but it's brown. And so tiny homes are really the mean to change the future of sewage handling, you know, cleaner rivers, and also the energy produced from solar and wind power generators. We can save, you know, air pollution. I mean, the future will be really cleaner and better for our next generations if these applies to tiny home communities and also new buildings.
And what about solar panels? Are those something that a lot of owners incorporate into their home, or are these, do they come with it?
They don't come with it, but they do incorporate if they want to. They're kind of expensive right now, but I see that in the near future, they'll be a lot cheaper. And we can even build our own. I mean, you buy the small pieces and then you just weld them together. It's a lot less costly. And as an example, our homes have flat roof. So there is this entire surface to put solar panels. And other homes, if they have triangle roof, you can see the sun for a while, but then when it goes to the other side, then it won't be effective as much. But I think the more people start using solar panels, the better roofing designs will come up. And also, we're thinking of wind power generators. There are smaller versions of them. You can just put a pole near your home and produce your own electricity at night and in the winter as well.
So I lived in Japan a long time in the 90s, and it's part of the culture to live in smaller homes, even in more rural parts of Japan. What kind of inspiration has the industry taken from the aesthetic of Japanese architecture and efficiency?
We're glad to say that we kind of changed how tiny homes are built. I think we're the pioneers. I can say that maybe there might be one or two homes built that way, similar or close to ours. We have downstairs, we have this small living area and kitchen, and then the bathroom. And upstairs, as we are aware of that, other companies build homes, the second floor has sleeping lofts, and you have to crawl into it. And then the staircase is only metal ladder, and it might be difficult to get on, get up and get down in the middle of the night when you're half sleepy. So we thought that how we can increase the size and the livability in it to make it easier for people. So we made an electronic system, and when you push a button, it's electric. It works with electricity or car battery, and the second floor walls and roof rises up. So we have the regular home style staircase, and then you go upstairs and you can stand up there. And if you have little kids, you can put even two bunk beds in one of the lofts, and then two lofts are connected with a bridge, so you don't have to get down and go take another ladder to go upstairs. So it makes it a lot easier. So Japanese homes, they use everything. I mean, it's wonderfully designed. They have a living room, and then at night, when you're eating, it becomes a dining room. When you're sleeping, it becomes a bedroom. So we think that with the convertible furniture, it can be done too. Like the downstairs, the living area could be also a bedroom when you have guests. And upstairs, since our roof rises up and then up to 7 feet, we can put, or they can, the buyers can put Murphy bed, and then during the day they have the entire area. Even though it's small, they can sit around and work there, and then at night just put down the bed and they have a bedroom. So yes, I think Japanese have the greatest idea, and this is how we can apply to ours, looking at them.
So where do you see the industry moving?
I think the future of the United States and many other countries, as well as Australia, New Zealand, and Scandinavia, people are going to need communities. And what we need for the future now is communities that people live next to each other, with each one having an area that they can plant their own vegetables and then share vegetables. If they have an extra of tomatoes, they can exchange it with a neighbor. If they have extra, pepper. So what we're looking into is in California, in Florida, Texas, and hopefully near New York, which is, land is a lot more expensive here, buy land and start communities like 10 acre or 300 homes together, so people connect. Because they're tiny homes, they'll be spending on good days. They can spend more time outside. They can talk to their neighbors. We can bring some of our good old-time habits that we used to have back, and then this will create a nicer environment, healthier environment. And since people who chooses to live in tiny homes, they really want to take care of the nature for the future generations. And we can learn a lot from each other. So I think the future is tiny house communities.
Fatih and Dennis Sott, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. We thank you for having us on your show.
Thank you, Alex.
Next on Sea Change Radio, I'm joined by San Francisco Supervisor Rafael Mandelman. Rafael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to have you on not to talk about San Francisco politics, because it's a very tangled web and most of the country doesn't want to even begin to follow the inner workings of it. But you're intimately familiar with the issue of homelessness, and it's a important issue all over the country. And why don't you first talk about your background and why you have a unique perspective on the homeless issue?
Yeah. I actually think more families have folks who have had experiences with mental illness and or homelessness than you would know. But when I was 11 years old, my mother, who probably had been struggling with mental health issues for much of her life, got significantly worse, and she was not able to take care of me after that point. And I ended up moving up to San Francisco and living with my grandmother initially, and then other families that sort of took me in and let me live with them in informal foster care. But my mother's life, continued to sort of spiral out, and she actually ended up in a homeless shelter for a period when I was, I think, a freshman in college. And I remember being, I was privileged to be in some really great academic institutions, and I was an undergrad at Yale at the time, and I was calling my mother from this ornate, amazing library where I was studying, and she was in a shelter. So when I was older, I got a conservatorship over her and eventually moved her up to San Francisco. But I do think that, there are this is not the entire homeless problem, but there are a chunk of our homeless population who are folks who are just sick, and we leave them out on our streets. And I think particularly in California, we leave a lot of mentally ill and drug addicted folks out there who we should not be leaving out there.
So catch us up on where things are today in San Francisco regarding homelessness and what templates you and your colleagues will look towards when you're trying to see what works.
Yeah. Well, I think the perception of most housed San Franciscans is that homelessness is worse than it has ever been before. And it's interesting because objectively the numbers have not increased in San Francisco all that much. The last homeless count, I think, showed something between 7,000 and 8,000 homeless people on the streets. That's sort of within the range of where it's been probably for 5 or 10 years. So there and at the same time, actually, regionally, the homeless population has gone up significantly. So in some ways, we're doing better than some of our neighbors in the region. But I think what people are reacting to is that the homeless population we have is older and sicker, more mentally ill folks, and more folks using a lot of really hard drugs, whether it's meth or opioids. You know, there's a growing phenomenon of needles all over and people going downtown and seeing folks shooting up. And I think there is a sense from, again, housed people in particular, that the level of public disorder has grown significantly. And so the challenge for elected officials is then to craft, you know, a response that meets the need of their constituents for public spaces they can use, but is also compassionate and humane and actually addresses the real problems of homeless people. And the responses have been pretty divergent, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine one person who spends $3 million on their slick new home and then has somebody pooping on their front yard or has needles there.
Right.
They have more of a voice in the political process, whether we like it or not, than that mentally ill person.
Right.
But we have to have compassion for both of these individuals.
Right. And, you know, even if you don't have a $3 million home, you get pretty annoyed if you walk out your door and there's human poop there, which is, also a growing phenomenon. So what we have right now going on in the city is pretty aggressive sweeps of homeless encampments by the current interim mayor. And that does, seemingly on at least a temporary basis, is directly addressing the concerns that people have been expressing about what's happening in their neighborhoods. I'm unconvinced that over time it's going to be sustainable and that it isn't just going to end up moving these folks around from sort of neighborhood to neighborhood. And that has been the experience of prior sweeps.
Yeah, break down the sweeps. What do they entail and what is a navigation center, for example?
The navigation centers are a response to this growing homeless population on the streets. I mentioned Gavin Newsom's housing policy, which was very focused on creating supportive housing, sort of more permanent housing options for people who are homeless. Newsom actually really did not believe in shelters. In his view, if you had a dollar to spend, you should spend that on permanent housing, not on shelter. And so, and that's a reasonable view. And so during his administration, we reduced the number of shelter beds we had in the city, significantly increased what we were spending on supportive housing, and that largely continued through the Lee administration, which succeeded Newsom. But of course, during that time, the street population is growing, the concerns of housed people are getting more acute about what's happening with the street population, and so the Board of Supervisors really pushed the idea that we needed to have some kind of reinvestment in shelter. And the navigation centers are supposed to be a really easy access point for folks to come out and off the streets. They may not have the same rules as more traditional shelters. You may be able to bring in your girlfriend or your boyfriend, your dog, your stuff. They really are supposed to be an enticement to get folks who might not otherwise engage with the system to get in off the streets, and particularly in areas that are experiencing the growth of these tent encampments, which we've seen over the last several years as well. Relatively new phenomena is not just homeless folks, but homeless folks living in groupings of 10 or 20 or 30 with tents. Interesting that it took until the last few years for this to emerge, but it's, you know, taken on kind of a life of its own in San Francisco over that period. And so you have very large encampments. Now, this is, again, a statewide phenomena. Orange County just cleared, I think, a 2-mile-long encampment that had hundreds of tents.
I saw a video of it. It was incredible how long it went for. Yeah. And you could understand if you were a homeless single mother, you would want some kind of community. There is a strength in numbers, even in a homeless population, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I spend a lot of time actually talking to homeless people on the street because I'm out campaigning. And of course, homeless people are interested in politics too. And so they come up and engage me in conversations. And their perspectives are very different on some issues from, you know, most housed people. You know, this homeless guy I was speaking to in the last week, you know, was telling me, you know, you politicians think that tents are the problem. Tents are the solution. Tents, you know, give us a place to be where we're not going to get rained on and keep us out of the way and keep us safe. And I hear that. I think it's untenable to have large tent encampments in urbanized areas. I just don't think the housed people are going to tolerate that.
So back to some of the more successful cities in dealing with situations like what San Francisco faces.
So if you look at, you know, European social democracies, they don't have anything like the tent cities or the homeless challenges that we have, largely because they invest heavily in housing for middle class and poor folks. They have social housing, just significantly greater investment in subsidizing housing for people who need it, and then also have much more robust healthcare systems. So, I think a big component of this is simply that we do not have enough housing. And some folks focus, particularly Senator Weiner, who represents San Francisco in the state legislature, are very focused on creating more market rate housing. Because we do have an overall shortage. We're in a desirable area. We're an economic powerhouse. Millions of people are moving to California, and we have not built enough housing to house them. And so, of course, that is creating creating the housing crisis. But we also, don't do nearly what other countries do in terms of making sure we're housing the people in the middle and lower end of the spectrum. So I think that's a big piece of it. And then I think as compared to certainly European countries and even other states in the United States, the fact that we did close the mental hospitals and then did not really replace them with anything leaves us with folks who I think 90-95% of us would agree are sick and should not be responsible for taking care of themselves. And yet they are until they get picked up by the police or taken to SF General.
Rafael Mandelman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the JBs, Fog Swamp, and Delaney and Bonnie.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.